Yeshua and the Oral Torah, the Second Temple Period. According to Perkei Avot 1 verse 1, the Oral Torah was passed on to the generations after Moshe, including those of the late Second Temple Period. In fact, Avot itself contains many quotations from distinguished sages who lived during that period. This, of course, was the age in which Yeshua lived and taught. Jesus lived in a Jewish world, according to Dr. David Flusser, professor emeritus at Jerusalem's Hebrew University, quote, which was flourishing within the framework of the written law, the Bible, and the oral law, which later became the Talmud, end of quote. Flusser contends that Yeshua was in the thick of that world's religious conflicts. According to a growing consensus of modern scholars of the Brit Hadashah, Yeshua lived as an observant Jewish man, debating with many prominent rabbis of his day over issues related to both the written and oral Torahs. Jesus was scrupulous in keeping the Jewish commandments, says Flusser. The question is, what was his relationship to the oral Torah? Not his authority. At least two things can be said about Messiah and the oral Torah. The first is that not only was he familiar with it, but in certain respects, he followed it. In Yeshua's day, there were two schools of Pharisaism, the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel, representing two distinct understandings of oral Torah. Shammai and Hillel were very influential rabbis of a generation just before Yeshua. According to Flusser, quote, when we examine Jesus' position on matters of Jewish law, it appears that on some things he accepted the view of the more stringent authorities, the school of Shammai, and on the others, especially on matters of ideology, he was closer to the school of Hillel, whose motto was, Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. These views become evident when we examine Jesus' teachings and compare them to the other rabbinical teaching of his day. End of quote. Apparently, Yeshua agreed with some interpretations of the written Torah which the oral Torah provided. However, accepting some teachings of oral Torah is far different than accepting its divine origin. Nor does it mean that he accepted or agreed with its authority. Man's laws over God's Torah. Let us look at one example which provides a clue as to Yeshua's true attitude toward the oral Torah. In Mark 7, verses 1 through 8, Yeshua discusses with some other Pharisees the issue of ritual hand-washing before a meal. Yeshua's disciples did not follow the teaching of this group of Pharisees, who took him to task for it. Verse 3 explains the Pharisees' custom. Quote, for the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they carefully wash their hands, thus observing the traditions of the elders. End of quote. The final phrase, observing the traditions of the elders, was conventionally used to denote the oral Torah. Yeshua was being reproved for failing to submit to the authority of oral Torah as observed by this group of Pharisees. Yeshua gave his reasoning and his intended teaching, and then uttered these crucial words in verses 7 and 8. Quote, rightly did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. But in vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the precepts of men. Neglecting the commandment of God, you hold to the tradition of men. End of quote. This was spoken as a rebuke to those who had criticized him for breaking the oral Torah. It strikes at the very heart of the issue of written versus oral Torah. He tells them, as he would on other occasions, quote, neglecting the commandment of God, you hold to the tradition of men. End of quote. Yeshua found no problem with the teachings of the oral Torah when they provided insights or explanations that were true and accurate to the written Torah. However, there were times when the oral Torah was granted authority equal to and even superseding that of the written. When this happened, Yeshua proclaimed the oral Torah to be merely the teachings of men, not of God. In issuing such a rebuke, he was also stating that he did not consider the oral Torah to be authoritative for the man of God, the man of Torah. The value of the oral Torah. We do not accept the authority of the body of Jewish literature known as the oral Torah, nor do we view it as the inspired word of God. However, there can be tremendous value in reading and studying rabbinic literature. In fact, even Yeshua followed some rabbinic traditions. Dr. David Friedman is a Messianic Jewish scholar living in Israel. An expert on the Second Temple period, Dr. Friedman points out that the early rabbinic literature, such as the Mishnah and Talmud, can be invaluable in helping us to understand the historical and religious background of the Brit Hadashah. Friedman states, quote, "As the Jewish Talmudic scholar Shmuel Safrai of Hebrew University has pointed out, rabbinic literature, and the Talmud in particular, is by far our best source for understanding the structure, priestly function, sacrificial methods, and festival ceremonies of the Second Temple. Since Yeshua lived in this world, since he carried out his teachings at the temple, and since he sacrificed and attended festival ceremonies there, it is worthwhile to be familiar with the Talmud's description of these areas." End of quote. The following list of rabbinic texts can be searched to find many possible background purposes. Mishnah Sanhedrin describes justice and court systems of the Second Temple period. Mishnah Yadayim describes Pharisaic purity ideas of Second Temple period. Mishnah Sukkot describe Pharisaic laws and customs. Mishnah Yoma describe the Second Temple Yom Kippur rituals. Dead Sea Scrolls, understanding Dead Sea sect views on purity, serving God, Messiah, and community. Perkei Avot, the rabbinic worldview of Yeshua's time. Book of Maccabees, the history of Israel 150 to 100 years before Yeshua, the start of Hanukkah holiday. Midot, description of the temple structure. Tamid, the description of the Second Temple daily ritual. Shekalim, the Second Temple taxation system. In addition to aiding our understanding of the Brit Hadashah, the Oral Torah can also serve to heighten the appreciation of the Church for the efforts that Jewish people have made throughout history to protect, preserve, spread, and interpret the Scriptures. While we may disagree with some rabbinic interpretations, there are nevertheless other areas in which the Oral Torah has been extremely helpful in its insights into the Torah and other parts of the Tanakh. Moreover, the rabbinic writings have been extremely beneficial in teaching us how to follow many commandments of the Torah. For example, how do we affix a mezuzah on the door? How do we celebrate Pesach? How do we properly slaughter a kosher animal for food? The Oral Torah provides many excellent suggestions for following these and other teachings of the written Torah. And while we do not consider the rabbi's instructions to be the only way to do these things, they nevertheless can prove very instructive. Furthermore, as we follow the rabbinic practices, so long as they do not contradict either the Tanakh or the Brit Hadashah, we are standing in solidarity with our people. Finally, reading and studying the Oral Torah lends tremendous insight into the minds of the great Jewish sages. As we learn what they thought, what they felt, and how they looked at life, we will be better able to appreciate the Jewish sensibility throughout the ages. It is hoped that this would help curb the anti-Semitism which has run rampant through much of the Church's history. It is now time for you, the members of our panel, to render an opinion. Is the Oral Torah a real, genuine Torah from the Holy One, equal to the written Torah in its power to transform a soul and in its spiritual authority? Does the written Torah permit us to assume an Oral Torah given by God to Moshe, but authoritative for every generation? Or are we to depend on the leading and teaching of the Spirit of God to apply Torah's precepts to our generation? Spiritual authority. At stake here, among other things, is the issue of spiritual authority. Are we to obey God's teachings as written? Or are we required to obey the megalith of minute details outlined by the rabbis in the Oral Torah? Some believe that the Oral Torah is a fixed entity. We must do, they say, only what the rabbis tell us we are allowed to do, as expressed both in the Talmud and in their offices today. But do their laws carry true spiritual authority equal to the "Thus saith the Lord" of the Tanakh? For the believer, the key issue is to live the Torah as God actually gave it. The first saying in Perkei Avot provides a sad clue to the rabbinical idea behind Oral Torah. After informing us of the genealogy of the Oral Torah, the writer of this Mishnah exhorts us to, quote, "make a fence for the Torah," end of quote. It must be said that the intentions behind this idea were beyond reproach. The sages, in search of a way to prevent their people from breaking the written Torah, decided to construct a fence around it. As Kehati writes, quote, "the Torah charges the rabbinical courts to devise provisions, decrees, and restrictions which will prevent a person from violating a law of the Torah," end of quote. This system of prevention, however, as admirable as it may seem, possesses an inherent flaw. What actually happens in this process is that the true Torah, God's teaching in regard to His righteousness, is changed into man-made laws which, not being the words of life, cannot bring forth life. Rabbi Shaul of Tarsus, himself thoroughly trained in the Oral Torah, aptly says concerning the Torah teachers of his day, "Since they did not know the righteousness that comes from God, they seek to establish their own, and in so doing, they do not submit to God's righteousness." Romans 10:1-8, our paraphrase. Law versus Torah. God has revealed His mind, heart, and righteousness in the written Torah. The original writers recorded what He spoke to them with 100% accuracy. No one has the right to make even one change in this written revelation. If a halakha is developed which does not match the Torah teaching exactly as written, it ceases to be consistent with the words of life, and hence cannot bring forth the life of Messiah in the believer. With this thought in mind, return to figure 1 on the insert with this tape. Notice a line inside the border of Torah and a line outside the border. Any halakha which hits the mark, or at least lands inside it, is life-giving Torah. Any and all halakha landing outside the mark, however, is not true Torah. The words of Torah are the protective guards, which God Himself set in place for His children. Just as Abraham protected God's protective guards, then so must we be found faithful to do the same. Genesis 26:5. When God gave the Torah, He also instructed us in how to view it. He specifically advised us that its commandments were not impossible to obey. Because this is true, and knowing the tendency of man in his flesh, God was warning us not to develop a mentality that says, "You must obey exactly as the experts say it must be obeyed, because their explanation is binding for their generation." Oral Torah consists of an interpretation of the written Torah and, according to the rabbis, an authoritative halakha based on that interpretation. Our loving Father knew what men would try to do with the written Torah, perverting it into an oral one. He knew that the Oral Torah experts would pronounce the believer unable to understand the Torah without their help. Knowing this tendency in people, the Lord wrote a safeguard for us in Deuteronomy 30:11-14. He said, quote, "For this commandment which I command you today is not too difficult for you, nor is it out of reach. It is not in heaven that you should say, 'Who will go up to heaven for us to get it for us and make us hear it, that we may observe it?' Nor is it beyond the sea that you should say, Who will cross the sea for us to get it for us and make us hear it, that we may observe it? But the word is very near you, in your mouth and in your heart, that you may observe it." End of quote. Rabbi Shaul exhorts Messianic believers to this effect in Romans chapter 10. Here, quoting Deuteronomy 30, verses 11 through 14, he explains how one who has God's righteousness views the Torah. He says, quote, "But the righteousness based on faith speaks thus, do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven, or who will descend into the abyss?" End of quotes. Why does the righteousness based on faith speak in this way? Because the person with God's righteousness knows what his original instructions to us were and still are. They are very clear. Shaul was well-versed in the oral Torah. He knew its pitfalls. He also knew that those who fostered the oral Torah were, in reality, turning the Torah into law. This law did not reflect the righteousness of God. Rather, it was the codification of man's righteousness. But Shaul said that one who has God's righteousness does not need to look high or low for its proper interpretation or application. Instead, God's Torah is always accessible to him. Romans 10, verse 2, teaches us that a person can be zealous for God with a zeal not based on knowledge. Does zealousness confirm or establish truth? According to Shaul's teaching in Romans 10, such a zealot merely establishes his own righteousness while ignoring God's righteousness as expressed in the written scriptures. It is important to bear in mind that Judaism, as known by some of its most prominent scholars, does not consider itself a legalistic religion. Indeed, some of its most ardent spokesmen would cringe at the idea. The eminent Jewish New Testament scholar Pinchas Lapide affirms this idea when he says, quote, "The rabbinate has never considered the Torah as a way of salvation to God. Rather, we regard salvation as God's exclusive prerogative, so that we Jews are the advocates of pure grace." End of quote. That may be true, at least in theory. But most of the Jewish world has either lost sight of that biblical understanding or practiced their faith in such a way as to convey that the purpose of their obedience to Torah is to earn a place in the world to come. Thus, we also concur with Bean when he says, quote, "In spite of this, Judaism's purported emphasis on grace, one of Paul's main problems was the teaching of Judaizers, who insisted that both Jewish and Gentile believers must obey the letter of the law." End of quote. Being well-versed in the traditional rabbinic thinking of his day, therefore, Shaul deemed it essential to counteract any semblance of legalism both within and without the believing community. Thus, his characterization of Judaism in Romans 10 was not only accurate, but central to his point. Zeal and sincerity notwithstanding, works-based righteousness has no place in God's kingdom. Has the true Torah been distorted by the assignment of divine authority to the oral Torah and by legalistic obedience to the written? Members of the panel, render your decisions. When the Master of Ceremonies intones, "Will the true Torah please stand up?" Will the oral Torah arise, or another? Chapter 7. Christian Misconceptions of the Torah. In Chapter 6, we looked at a Jewish misconception of God's Torah. Now we will examine a Christian misconception of the Torah. We will see historically how some attempted to discourage believers from following the Torah in two different ways. First, by suggesting that the Torah had been done away with, and second, by changing the mental and verbal concepts of Torah into a concept called law. Let us look briefly at church history. Here we can learn much about what motivated some of the ancient church leaders to discourage believers from following the Torah. Then, after having established the necessary historical foundation, we will examine some selected passages from the Brit Chadashah which are often used to teach against Torah observance. A bitter history lesson. Have you ever tried to turn back 1,800 years of history? In essence, if we are to develop and teach a biblically accurate theology of the Torah, that is precisely what we must do. Christian misunderstanding of the Torah is a complex issue. It stems from a gross misinterpretation of several biblical passages, mostly in the writings of Shaul of Tarsus. But this contemporary misinterpretation is bolstered by approximately 1,800 years of anti-Jewish rhetoric from some of the Church's so-called finest exegetes, the Church Fathers. I, Ariel, first studied Church history over 20 years ago both in Bible college and in seminary. My professors were truly gifted, godly men, teaching excellent courses from textbooks which are still used in many evangelical theological schools today. Looking back, however, I wonder, why were we not taught about the Jewish believers? Why was so little mentioned about the relationship between the church and the Jewish people? Why do these textbooks present such a rosy picture of the church fathers when some of them were among the most anti-Jewish people who have ever lived? We do not know the full answer to these questions. Perhaps, because there were so few Jewish believers 20 years ago, there was simply little or no interest in these subjects. But whatever the reason, the fact remains that these curricula not only omitted some of the most significant events in the lives of the early believers, the majority of whom were Jewish, but actually covered up the real stories behind many of the theological decisions of the Church Fathers and councils. Whether or not these omissions were perpetrated consciously, the result is that many passages in the Brit Chadashah have been grossly misinterpreted with an anti-Torah bias throughout the centuries. Let us look at some of the history of the early church in order to see how this occurred.